Pushkin.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, they're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet, empowering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at IBM.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Hey everyone, today we're continuing our celebration of Black Music Month with one of my all-time favorites, jazz legend Sonny Rollins. Rollins is dubbed the saxophone colossus. He's an American tenor and composer who is widely regarded as one of the most influential jazz musicians ever. With several awards under his belt, a Grammy Award for Lifetime Achievement and the National Medal of Arts, to name a few, some even venture to call him the greatest living improviser. Sadly, now at 91 years old, Rollins no longer plays as a result of pulmonary fibrosis. But he is able to look back at an 8-decade career that took him all the way from the beginnings of bebop to playing with the Rolling Stones and all over the world. On today's episode, I spoke to Sonny Rollins by phone about one of his first big gigs at 18, way back in 1949, playing alongside other jazz icons like Bud Powell and Fats Navarro. He also explains why he no longer actively listens to music, and for the first time ever, how Charlie Parker is the reason he kicked drugs. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's my phone conversation with the great Sonny Rollins. I want to talk about early in your career. You were 18 years old in 1949. That was your first like professional date. And the first that I can figure was with Babs Gonzalez on St. Louis Blues. Does that seem true?
I know that I began recording in the late 40s. So I would imagine that that might be true. I can't verify exactly.
Do you remember Babs Gonzalez pretty well?
Oh, sure. Babs Gonzalez was like a character. You know, I remember Babs very well. Babs liked my playing a lot. And I used to make some of these gigs that Babs Gonzalez had. Pile up a lot of musicians in the car, and we'd go down to Philly, or we'd go up to Boston, or places in the immediate area, and play. So I got a chance to play with some of my idols. I got a chance to play with Fats Navarro.
I want to bring that up. The same year, when you're still 18, you got to play on some pretty incredible Bud Powell records. Well, Bouncing with Bud, 52nd Street Theme, Dance of the Infidels. I mean, just real, real classics. And you're playing on there with Fats Navarro, the amazing trumpet player. It's insane.
Yeah, I know. I guess I had too many stars in my head to even stop and realize what I was doing.
Yeah.
Oh, but, you know, so this is, I credit Babs Gonzalez with doing that, with getting me on a lot of jobs with Festival, I think. I'm sorry, I can't remember something, but some other the best players around played with some of these jobs. And I was a young cat. And my having an opportunity to play with them was tremendous.
At 18, playing with people like Bud Powell and Fats Navarro, were you nervous at all?
Well, I was too stupid to be nervous.
That might be a good thing.
So I always felt that if they wanted me there, then I'll just, you know, that I should be there. Mm-hmm. I was never really one of these guys that felt intimidated.
Yeah.
I just felt, well, look, if they want me to be here, then I'm just, you know, I guess I'm supposed to be here. So it wasn't bad. So I went on and did what I did, but it was certainly not on the level with J.J. Johnson and all of these people that I was playing with when I was a teenager.
Right. I mean, Roy Haynes, who we thankfully, just like you, we still have around these days, he was on those Bud Powell sessions as well, the drummer Roy Haynes. Do you ever have the urge to call someone like that these days and just sort of confirm that these things actually happened?
I called Roy up on his birthdays, and I always call him up and we talk about things that we can both remember. So Roy, we were a bunch of young kids wanting to play music, and Roy moved up in our neighborhood, up on Sugar Hill, they called it. We all knew him, and then Roy was playing with Lester Young.
You must have loved Lester. I mean, I can imagine Lester must have been an inspiration for you.
Lester Young was God, you know, and it was so good to get to know Lester Young and to know that Lester Young liked me, because we used to be up in Lester's apartment at the Alvin Hotel up on Broadway, and guys would be, Lester would look out the window, and if there were some guys coming, musicians, he would call down and tell the guys, no, say I'm not home. So he didn't, you know, a lot of people came to see him, but he didn't abide everybody. And he liked me. He liked me and Max Roach used to come by there. And I got a good friendship with the great press.
Yeah.
And that gave me a lot of validation that I was doing something right.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm realizing Roy has a birthday coming up in a few days here, so I guess you'll be probably calling him, huh?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know it's coming up. Yeah, I'll find out about it.
Yeah.
And I will definitely call him. Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Man, Roy will be turning 97. You're 91 now. How long ago does an experience like that feel at this point? Like, does it even feel like it was in the same lifetime?
Well, yes and no. That's a tough question, because a lifetime means, you know, the last week could be a different lifetime in a way of speaking.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
In a way, it's a different lifetime, yes, but still, it was a lifetime which I was involved in, so it's not that different. But yes, it was different in so many ways. Different musicians around, different venues around. You know, so lifetime is a difficult word. Since I believe in reincarnation, I accept reincarnation. So maybe when you say it was a different lifetime, it brings up too many contradictory things to be able to answer that precisely.
No, I see what you mean. I was watching an interview you did the other night in 1962 on Ralph Gleason's show that he used to have, Jazz Casual. You were the same age during the filming of that I am now. You're 32. And you were referring to yourself as old in that taping. You referred to yourself as kind of like an old cat now. I'm curious what advice you might give yourself at 32 now.
You know, I've made so many mistakes in life. I've done some good things in life. I was learning. It was a learning experience. I think I was born a fairly positive person. They used to call me the jester when I was a little boy. So, and playing. So I think I had a positive personality all through my life. You know, that's what we think, and it's good, but things happen to us. We get tested in life, and it's a long trip, you know, and I've known so many people that didn't make it all the way and ended up in terrible situations. I was talking about my friend, he's a great drummer from Chicago named Ike Day. And I played with Ike Day when I was in Chicago back in 1949. He was strung out on drugs, and I was sort of strung out on drugs at the time. So that was a different world, but it was one of those rivers I had to cross.
Yeah.
So that it's hard to look back. You know, I made a lot of mistakes in life. I did some things in life which I, like my music, I was always trying to get better. Mm-hmm. But as I said, I was a guy that wasn't afraid of trying to do something and playing with superior musicians and all of that.
No, you definitely
because
did.
Because, I felt that I should be there. They wanted me to be there.
Yeah.
We have to learn. We have to try to be the golden rule and all that stuff. Got to try to do it. If we don't get it now, we have to try it again. Like they said in the TV commercial, pay me now or pay me later.
I'm gonna start quoting that.
Yeah, man, you got to get it right. You can't do anything and get away with it. You got to get it right.
Yeah.
You don't get it right now, you're going to have to get it right later because you reap what you sow. See, some of these things are very important to remember that what life is about. Life is to find out the reason for life. What does it mean? And that goes on and on, man. Who knows how many lives we have to live? Could be a billion, trillion. Who knows? I don't know. But I know that you can't get it generally in one lifetime. Some people are really advanced that I meet in life. I say, wow, their journey, they know a lot more than I do. Then some people, I'm ahead of some other people in their journeys. I say, wow, I've learned some things this guy hasn't learned, or this girl hasn't learned. All of these things mean something.
We're going to take a quick break here, but we'll be back with more from Sonny Rollins.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segee, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, they're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with more from Sonny Rollins. You know, I'm thinking about what you've sowed musically, and that certainly is more than I think many people, you know, would ever contribute to one lifetime. And I was thinking about the year, particular 1956 for you. That year, you played a date with Miles Davis that included Charlie Parker. Do you remember that date?
Oh, yeah. Collector's Items.
Collector's Items, exactly. You played Serpent's Tooth. Did you interact with Bird much on that session?
Well, Bird was another one of my gods. So, of course, there was a lot. Well, there were some other things happening on that particular session. And, I guess I might as well say it. At that time, I was still on drugs. So I hadn't seen Charlie Parker in a while. So he said, oh, he said, so, Sonny. So I told him, I think he said, yeah, how you doing? And I think he meant, have I got my life together? And I tell him, oh, yeah, man, I'm doing good, you know. So I lied to him. I wasn't doing good. And some guys in the band later on during the session, they ratted on me. They said, oh, man, Sonny was out getting high with us last night. So anyway, later on the session, after he found out that I had lied to him, I noticed something in him, how destroyed he was, how despondent he was to know that I had. And not just me. Then I realized, man, Bird was so involved with all of the young musicians trying to follow his music and his lifestyle.
Yeah.
It was killing him.
The drugs and all that, yeah.
Yeah, knowing that all these young guys were using drugs. It was killing him. And I saw that at that session. So, you know what? I said, okay, that's it. I said this to myself. I'm going to get off of drugs and show Charlie Parker that he shouldn't be so down because some people are following his positive effect on their life, not the negative effect. And that's when I made my decision to get off of drugs.
Wow, I didn't know that. I had no idea.
Yeah, well, that's part of this life that I'm living here.
Yeah.
So actually, you know what? I got off of drugs. I don't know whether you need to know all of that, but it wasn't easy.
No, it's very fascinating. Did you ever get a chance to tell Charlie that you got clean?
Okay, well, what happened was this. There was a drug rehabilitation place in Lexington, Kentucky. It was the first place where it was like the Betty Ford Clinic before the Betty Ford Clinic. And a lot of people were there, people that were into drugs, movie stars were there. We were treated like patients, not as criminals. Anyway, so I was there for the cure. The cure was, I think, 4 months. I left Lexington in 5/5/55. That's when I was discharged, or whatever you want to call it. But the unfortunate, maybe so, maybe not, part of it was that Charlie Parker passed away 1 month before I got out of Lexington, Kentucky. So I never got the chance, which I was waiting to do, going up to Bird and say, hey, man, I'm straight. Charlie, I'm straight, man. I would convince him, or he would know that I was so anxious because I was so ashamed of lying to him earlier on this record date you just recalled. So I was so anxious for this to happen. I would be able to see him and convince him that I wasn't going to disgrace him anymore. But unfortunately, that was denied me. However, I do believe in things like the afterlife and all that stuff. So I think Charlie Parker knew, wherever he was at, that, oh, Sonny got my message.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it, you know, really, when you think about it, too, it's pretty great timing that you got clean in 55. Because, I mean, in 56, your career is really insane, your output. I'm thinking about, you know, you do Saxophone Colossus, Tenor Madness. You do Brilliant Corners with Thelonious. You do a lot of your work with the Max Roach and Clifford Brown Quintet. Just really incredible stuff is happening. I wanted to ask you, that Brilliant Corners album with Thelonious Monk, that record really blows my mind when I listen to it. It's like spectacularly complex, especially that title track. Do you remember, was that a tough session? A tough couple of sessions?
Very tough session. Yeah. Very tough session. It was a little different than the music that Monk had played before, as I remember. It was tough music. But everybody liked that record a lot. They always mention that when they're talking about Monk's accomplishments.
Yeah. Did you enjoy playing on it?
I think so. It was a hard record to make. You know, it was hard. Everybody didn't get it the first go around. But sure. Playing with Monk was a celestial experience, whatever came out of it.
Yeah.
And I had that experience. And everybody liked that record a great deal.
I know Ernie Henry, another tenor player, he ended up leaving, I think, one of the sessions. And then Clark Terry came in to sort of play. Did you ever feel like leaving?
Oh, no. Maybe if they kicked me out, but I'm not leaving on my own, no.
You're not quitting.
No. They'd have to show me the door. There was a lot of great people on that record. There was Oscar Pettiford was there, Max Roach, I believe, and Monk played the Chillette. I forget everybody that was on the record, but there was some... It was great. It was a little different than some of the music you had done before. So it was quite a landmark.
Yeah. Can you tell me about playing in the Max Roach Clifford Brown Quintet with yourself and George Morrow and Richie Powell? It sounds to me like you guys had incredible chemistry. Did it feel that way to you at the time?
Of course, I had played with Max a couple of times in New York. But... one night with the band, with Clifford, and it was different. It was right, you know, I was doing more. I think I played as a sideman or something on some record at Max Roach in New York. But when I played with that band, it was really, I don't know, I'm glad it sounded like that because I had a great experience playing with... Clifford Brown, and Clifford was such a straight-up guy, he was such a straight-up player, one of the best players as we know. When I look back today and I talk to different guys, all these young guys, Clifford Brown was their favorite trumpet player. So he was quite a guy, but he was also a great person. And I learned a lot from Clifford because Clifford... was playing all of this music, but he was not a guy that was messing around with drugs. He wasn't that, you know. So I said to myself, wow, man, listen to all this music. He can play, and he's not, it has nothing to do with his personal life. So you don't have to be using drugs or drinking a lot or anything like that to play as much music as he did. And that was inspirational to me. And I really learned that. I said, wow, man, if Clifford can do it, man. All his music he's playing, I can do it. You don't need drugs to play.
Yeah.
So he was a grand, we were good friends. I mean, you know, I was really close. After he passed away, when we were playing in the band, and sometimes I'd channel Clifford. I'd say, hey, Clifford, man, what should we do right here? I mean, I'd talk to him like that about the music.
Wow.
And then he'd answer me. And that went on for a while before that band broke up. Max got other trumpet players, of course, but that happened for a while. And then after a while, I stopped channeling Clifford and let him go on his journey, his life journey. But I channeled him for a long time after he passed. And then, you know, and we had to play the same music, a lot of the same music.
We'll be right back with more from Sonny Rollins after a quick break.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, they're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
We're back with the rest of my conversation with Sonny Rollins. Do you remember where you were when you found out Clifford and Richie Powell passed away in that car accident?
Well, the band was in Brownie and... Richie were in Philadelphia, where they lived. Richie lived in Willow Grove, a sort of suburb. Brownie was in Philly. So we had been on the road. The band had been on the road. So just we had a little time off before we went. I think we were going out to California. But on the way, we were going to play in Chicago. So anyway, the days we had off, Max and myself came to New York. And George Morrow came to New York, you know. And the next job was Chicago. And we left Chicago traveling by car. And Brownie and Richie Powell left Philadelphia traveling on the Pennsylvania Turnpike by car. Max and I and George Martin, we got to Chicago and we, you know, waiting around there. I remember Miles was playing at a club right down the street on 63rd Street. So while we were waiting for Clifford to arrive in Chicago, we got the bad news. It was a shocker. I mean, we were crying like babies. And it was, you know, it was a big event because everybody loved Brownie.
Yeah.
I mean, Richie, too. But Brownie was, you know, Brownie was the leader. And it had gotten more accolades than Richie. You know, Richie was sort of...
Richie was making his name at the time, really, huh?
He was making his name at the time.
Yeah. Incredible player.
But Brownie had made his name, really.
Did you see Bud Powell in the sort of aftermath of that or ever get a chance to talk with Bud Powell, who was Richie Powell's brother? Do you know how he took that?
I don't know how he took that, no.
Okay, just curious.
No, I don't know.
Did you feel like that band had more yet to do?
I think so. We think, you know, Clifford and I used to practice together all the time, and besides the gigs, but we were trying to get closer, you know, as to musicians playing a saxophone and trumpet. So we were trying to get closer, trying to get tighter with our the things we had to play ensemble and everything. And I was new in the band, so I was trying to learn the book and all of this stuff. But besides that, it was just, besides the repertoire, I was playing with Clifford that he and I tried to always get closer. So, yeah, I think we had a lot to do.
Yeah. Do you think that had anything to do with you sort of stripping things back and going to like that trio format the next year, just you on sax and then bass and drums? Was that related musically at all?
I don't remember when I did the first trio albums.
That would have been 57.
Right around that time?
Yeah, maybe 6 months later, 8 months later would have been just the, yeah.
I don't know if it, no, I don't believe so because I had always enjoyed the smaller instrumentation. You know, in fact, when I first met Miles Davis, I was playing trio. And we were playing opposite Miles. You know, Miles was the stars and we were the local band. And I think I was playing trio at that time. So no, I think the trio idea didn't stem from the Clifford Brown period.
Were you surprised how curious people found that idea of you just playing in that small trio, you bass, drums, like you did on Way Out West or Night at the Vanguard?
I hope that it would be received well.
Well, I think it was. I think it absolutely was. I mean, it's. Those seem to have really stood the test of time in an incredible way, but it's funny also just in a way how curious people find that, you know, that it's like, oh, whoa, this is pianoless trio, you know, it seemed to sort of.
Well, I always liked that, and I played with great piano players, so it's no reflection on piano, but I liked the idea of just a rhythm section and, allowing me to sort of be free, you know, completely free, just compose things in my own mind and create the harmonies and the musical situations that just came to me. I had a rhythm behind me. I had the bass and I had the drums to keep things moving.
Yeah.
And I had the freedom to conceive of all of these things. So that's why I like playing like that. It had nothing to do with anything else.
I got you. There's some wild playing on those records from you. some incredible, you know, even from the other cats, you know, like Night at the Vanguard. There's a couple of bass solos on that record that are great as well, you know?
Yeah, I tried to get his guys that weren't afraid to play without a piano.
Yeah.
See, a lot of guys just, you know, would be reticent to do that. Well, yeah, you know, because the piano fits right in with a bass, you know, yeah, like ham and eggs.
Yeah.
See, they, I mean, that's all, wow, piano, drums, yeah, bass, yeah, it's playing, it's all, you know, those guys can wake up in the middle of the night and throw them, and they'd be right in tune to the next note. So it was something which, you know, was somewhat of a challenge to them.
Yeah. It was Wilbur Ware, by the way.
Wilbur Ware. We used to have a joke about Wilbur. We used to call him Wilbur B. Ware.
That's great. Elvin Jones also on drums on that, just so we
let everyone know.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible trio, man.
And then I had some other guys on that, on other parts of the record. I had a Pete LaRocca and another guy from
Donald Bailey,
Baltimore.
Who is Donald Bailey? I can't figure out who this Donald Bailey bass player. I know there's a drummer, Donald Bailey,
right?
But there's a drummer, Donald Bailey. But is there also a? But I can't find anything out about a bass player, Donald Bailey.
I know. He was very under. For musician, nobody knew much about him.
What? How did you know him?
My good friend went to school down there at a black college. I forget what it was, which is, you have to forgive me, you know.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
When you get at a certain age, your memory, you know, your short-term memory, it goes, you know.
It's your memory's better than mine.
I think about it like 10 minutes from now, but I need it now. But so that's
fine. It's fine.
But anyway, no, he was known in the area, you know, and he's a good player. You know, he played good. I liked him on those things.
I always thought maybe it was someone that, like, just couldn't say, like, you couldn't say who it was for some contractual reason or something. Because I was like, I can't figure out who he was. Yeah, I can't figure out who this guy is.
I know, Donald Bailey, and unfortunately he passed not too long after those records came out.
Man.
But they did a great job of accompanying me on that.
Yeah, absolutely. The record Sunny Side Up that you did with Dizzy Gillespie and Sonny Stitt in 59?
Oh, yeah.
How did that come together?
Well, that came together through Norman Granz.
Okay, of course.
Do you know who Norman Granz is?
He did jazz at the Philharmonic, right? He put on all those shows.
He was a promoter.
Discovered
a
Oscar
lover
Peterson.
Of jazz.
Yeah.
He did a lot of promotion of different people. And his crown achievement was jazz at the Philharmonic. But he was a big-time jazz promoter. He heard me playing someplace, so he got to be a big fan of mine. And then he was his date. I mean, he arranged a date. That's how it turned out to be Sonny and Dizzy.
Yeah. Were you friendly with Dizzy at that time, or did you know him decently well or at all?
Yeah, I was friendly with Dizzy. You know, if you know Dizzy at all, you've got to be friendly with him.
Hard
because
guy not to
he's
like?
He's just that type of guy. He's always going to be something light and amusing that becomes part of the conversation. And, you know, Dizzy was a wonderful guy. Dizzy was a guy that always was teaching people stuff. You know, he'd always, a young musician would be around, and he'd come in and, you know, at the show, he'd get up on the piano and show the piano playing some chords and some chords, you know, stuff like that. He was a great natural teacher. I mean, not in any, he wasn't trying to diminish the guy. I don't mean like that. I mean, we were happy to have Dizzy Gillespie there.
Yeah.
That was his wont. He wanted to to teach, you know, not to disparage the other guy at all. Not right. in that sense in the least.
Yeah.
Just everybody was listening to what he was doing, saying and playing.
That record, Sunny Side Up, was kind of an anomaly, I feel like, in your catalog. At least, you know, at the time, it felt maybe much more like a Dizzy record than anything else, which I think is probably only natural.
I think it was a Dizzy record, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the three of you guys. I mean, you know, it's named Sunny Side
yeah,
Up, so it's named after you.
But I mean, it was Dizzy Gillespie. It was his session, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. No. That's fair. It's such a cool record.
Yeah, some people liked it a lot. Some people, musicians, really thought that that was one of my best records.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You recorded that 57, but it comes out 59. The next year, 1960, Lee Morgan quoted you on a Jazz Messenger's record. He did your little phrase that you do.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and Lee quoted you on this song called The Opener on a Jazz Messengers record just the next year.
Oh, so. That's good. Yeah, no, Lee is a great player. Yeah, no, Lee used to come when I was playing with Max and Clifford in Philadelphia at a club there. Lee would come by, you know, to hit Clifford. I mean, that's another guy. I mean, a young guy that all loved Clifford so much. So anyway, that's when I met Lee, and he used to play outside the club with his mouthpiece alone. He would show me what he could do just playing his mouthpiece. Wow. And that's why I'd say, hey, man, that's good, yeah. Lee Morgan, I mean, but he's great, man. He's a great player.
You never got to play with him, did you?
I don't think so.
Oh, man, that would have been...
I don't think so. No, I think that's one of the trumpet players that I missed.
Would have been great to hear you guys together, man.
Yeah, I wonder why that must have been. Yeah, I'm sure I would have been inspired, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious, is there anyone you admire outside of jazz in terms of musically?
Oh, yeah, I admire all of the great musicians from the centuries. I like J.S. Bach. I like Brahms, Debussy, Ravel. I like Fats Waller, Louis Jordan, of course.
Louis Jordan.
One of my favorite. You know, and also I like everybody.
Incredible.
Yeah, I appreciate all kinds of music.
Great. Do you listen to music at all still these days?
Excuse me?
What do you listen to? What are you enjoying listening to now?
I don't listen to too much music. It's strange. I've listened to so much music in my life. I still think music all the time. I'm still playing my horn, even though I can't play my horn anymore. I'm still imagining passages that I would be fingering on my instrument, although I can't do that anymore. So I'm listening to music. I love music, and occasionally I get to hear music on some of the radio stations I have on. I'll hear some music, and I love it. But I don't go out to listen to music anymore. I don't mean go out in the street. I mean I don't seek out music anymore.
Is it frustrating to hear it in a sense, since you can't, you know, just pick up your horn and play some figures or anything?
To a certain extent, I wouldn't look at it completely as frustration, but that's part of it. Because I hear something and I feel what I would be doing, what I can do. So in a sense, I would say it's not all frustration. Because I love music, and listening to somebody that I admire is great. It's a great feeling. So frustration might come a little bit because I can't contribute being the guy that was part of the scene.
Sonny, it is a pleasure and an honor speaking with you. I hope we get to do it again.
Okay, man. Take it easy and God bless.
You as well, sir.
All right, man.
All right. Bye, Sonny.
Thanks to Sonny Rollins for taking us back to some of the earliest, most important moments in American recorded music history. To hear our favorite Sonny Rollins songs, check out the playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Brent Holliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you like this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the unconventional awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.